Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to another edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing from Fiona Longhurst of Royal Voluntary Service about a new free booklet that they've just published, entitled Stay Safe, Warm and Well. And, as the title suggests, it's full of tips about how you can look after yourself during the continuing pandemic. And it also details various services that the RVS can provide to help you. Then we'll be hearing about Brighton and Hove Arts Council's annual award for an outstanding contribution to the arts locally, and speaking to this year's recipient, Deborah Roberts, of the Brighton Early Music Festival. A representative from the Coal Merchants Federation will be giving us advice on what we can and can't burn on our open fires and solid fuel stoves, following legislation by the government earlier this year. And finally, an expert on the menopause will be advising our female listeners on how to deal with it. As usual, we'll be giving out various phone numbers, website addresses and email addresses during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So, let's get started by hearing about the new booklet entitled Stay Safe, Warm and Well, which has just been published by the Royal Voluntary Service. To find out more about it, I spoke to Fiona Longhurst, who is a director at the service, and I began by putting it to her that the Royal Voluntary Service, or RVS as it's now called for short, used to be the Women's Voluntary Service.
You're right, the WRVS. That's right, it did. It changed name on its 75th anniversary, which is about 2013, I think, because we thought we'd let some men in.
Yes, don't particularly want single-sex organisations when they don't have to be these days, do we?
No, and actually it's very much now everybody's welcome. We've just had our busiest year, obviously through the pandemic, since the Second World War.
Was that when it was first established?
Yeah, the Second World War, it was just literally before 1938, just before war broke out. That's why it was established, to sort of support on the home front, really, to help civilians who were caught up in the Blitz and things. It's called the WVS at the time, and they were sort of dispatched to sort of bandage people up, to hand out tea and coffee, you know, and they got involved in all kinds of things, like, you know, salvage programs, feeding the agricultural workers. There was amazing variety of tasks.
And they're still going strong today, obviously.
They're going strong today, yeah.
Right, now, can you tell me about the survey that you've just conducted?
The survey we conducted was with Yakult, who are one of our long-term partners, and we wanted to establish whether people had effectively kind of returned to their normal behaviours in terms of looking after themselves since the worst of the pandemic last year. And what we found, that there were many people actually that still perhaps putting off seeing their optician or dentist, for example. They had got into routines of getting takeaways far too often, perhaps had shelved their exercise routines and so on, and even hadn't quite got back into the habit of socialising as much as they did. And socialising is incredibly good for you. It's brilliant for your mental well-being, seeing friends, relatives and neighbours. And actually, people hadn't quite got back into the habit of that either. What we wanted to do was shine a light on this through the survey and actually encourage people to take steps, particularly as we head into winter, to take those self-care opportunities and make the best of it. So what we've actually done with Yakult, who kindly supported us in this, we've created a guidebook called Stay Safe, Warm and Well, particularly useful for people who perhaps have their own sort of health conditions, more vulnerable people in the community, or even people who are perhaps a bit older and frail. And so a wonderful guide to share with others that you might care for, as well as take a look at yourself. And it provides a host of advice on really looking after yourself before, you know, in advance of winter.
So what you're saying is that it's not just that people are reluctant to go out and mix in company, but they've also change what they do at home, and they're tending to neglect looking after themselves at home. Is that right?
that seems to come through in the survey. Yes, they're even to the extent that people are saying that they are not taking as much care of their actual home as well as their own person. So a lot more clutter about not getting repairs attended to and things like that. And I think sometimes this neglect actually is a sign of poor mental health overall. And we know that the pandemic had a huge impact on people's mental well-being. As our RVS, we support people who struggle with vulnerabilities, including mental health, as well as people that are physically struggling and need a bit of help to organise themselves, get shopping in. And we provide volunteer effort to support those individuals. We've got a number of things that actually we offer, which we'd recommend people consider. For example, you know, mental well-being, definitely great to try and boost the amount of social contact you have. Doesn't have to be face-to-face, can be on the phone. And so regular chats with friends, neighbours, family is brilliant. If you don't have that on offer, then there are services that you can rely on. So we work with the NHS on the NHS Volunteer Responders Programme, has a great service called Check-in and Chat. And it's in our guidebook, actually. They can literally, people can call the number 0808 196 3646. And you can request volunteer support. And that can be someone to help with your shopping, or it could be simply somebody to have a check-in phone call with you, which is hugely valuable. And actually, the volunteers love it as well. So it's got a double benefit, really. We also have something called our virtual village hall at RVS, which is something that if you don't fancy going out, you can actually undertake at home, get involved in that at home. And we run daily live groups and classes where people can get involved in doing some craft activity, or they can undertake some gentle physical exercise. But again, it's bringing you together with others. And actually, that's been really popular, both through lockdown, but also as we've come out, that's now still extremely popular, and it's free. So it's very accessible as well.
And all this is mentioned in the publication you were talking about, is it?
That's correct, yes. And actually, the publication also covers everything from, you know, how to prepare for bad weather to come, you know, stocking up on essentials, you know, making sure you've got those essential numbers, phone numbers written down for people you might need in an emergency. And it's a helpful sort of sheet at the back where you can jot down all of those things. So it's in one easy to find place. Advice and guidance on, you know, making sure you get your gas appliances checked. It's something that, you know, you might easily overlook, but actually we all should be doing every 12 months, actually. And when the cold weather does hit, making sure that you keep warm at home. We advise that the heating should be on at about 18 degrees. You know, people might be concerned about heating bills this year. If so, you can talk to your energy provider, visit Ofgem. But also you might want to consider getting a smart meter, which can help you monitor the energy that you're using. But also important to keep those hot drinks coming. You know, make sure you're wearing plenty of jumpers when the cold weather comes so that you don't get chilly, because that's really important. And of course, it's worth also pointing out that particularly this year, but if you're eligible for a flu jab, absolutely get that flu jab. And of course, the COVID booster program is very much rolling out at the moment, and making sure that you get that third jab if you're eligible for it is crucial. And the other thing that we have in the guidebook is around, you know, keeping your brain active, actually, because I think that's really important as well. And that can be as simple as, you know, making sure you, rather than just sitting in front of the television, you perhaps say do some brain training through sort of puzzles to keep your brain active. You know, there's some fantastic puzzle books out there. There's, you know, the Sudokus, those sorts of things can actually really help to keep your brain ticking over. And that's important as well, particularly if you're restrained in terms of you need to be at home more, perhaps you haven't got great mobility, then it's all the more important, I think, to make sure that you're utilising all these resources that are out there.
Well, we've talked a lot about this booklet you've produced. It's called The Safe, Warm and Well Guide. How can people get hold of it?
They can visit our website. The booklet has been produced with the support of Yakult, which is fantastic. And you can go to our website, which is royalvoluntaryservice.org.uk. And there you can download a copy of that booklet, which hopefully people will find extremely helpful. In addition to that, you know, if you need volunteer support, you can look on our website for our Royal Voluntary Service help. In addition, we work with the NHS to provide NHS volunteer responders, which is on 0808 196 3646 to arrange volunteer help. You can also volunteer for the NHS Volunteer Responders and RVS. And we'd urge you to consider that as well, because it's hugely rewarding and connects you with your community and actually makes you feel better as well. So the doors are very much open for new volunteers for the winter period ahead.
And of course, some of those tasks, such as making phone calls to people who are locked in, can be done from home. So you don't even need to have to go out.
That's right. If listeners are interested in undertaking that, then they just need to go to our website and look for the NHS Volunteer Responders tag on it and follow the links.
Now, there are some people who don't have internet access. Can they contact you by phone?
Yes. The number for that is 0330 555 0310. That's the Royal Voluntary Service number. And the NHS Volunteer Responders number is 0808 196 3646.
And presumably, if they phone you up, you'll be able to send them a copy of the booklet.
Yes, we would absolutely be able to do that.
Fiona Longhurst, thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to find out more information, you can go to the RVS's website, which is royalvoluntaryservice.org.uk. That's royalvoluntaryservice, typed all as one word, .org.uk. If you don't have internet access, you can phone them up on 0330 555 0310. That's 0330 555 0310. Well, just recently, the Brighton and Hove Arts Council made an award for an outstanding contribution to the arts locally. And this year, the award went to Deborah Roberts, who for the last 20 years has been the driving force behind the Brighton Early Music Festival. The presentation ceremony took place at the beginning of November, and I went along to the presentation with a microphone. While I was there, I spoke to Jane Osler, who was doing the presentations, and I began by asking her if this award is something that's made annually.
It is. Since 1996, we've asked our member groups, who number more than 90, and our individual supporters to nominate individuals they feel have made a significant contribution to the not-for-profit arts in our area.
And how do you actually choose the award winners?
Well, it's quite a process. The trustees and the committee review the application, and we look at criteria for the contribution, the breadth of their contribution, how much of it is for not-for-profit, how much of it is on their own time. They're just some of the things. It's not easy, though.
No, I can imagine. There are quite a large number of not-for-profit arts groups operating in the Brighton and Hove area, aren't there?
Indeed there are, and they play a vital role in the well-being of the community. They engage all sorts of groups in the arts, whether it be singing or theatre or reading or dance, music. They just enable people to participate and get pleasure from that.
It must be quite difficult when you're trying to decide on the award winners to differentiate between the different arts.
It is hard, and sometimes nominations perhaps come from one particular field. This year, sort of post-pandemic, we have, as you probably saw this evening, nominations across the board, from theatre to music, with the French Circle and many others. So it was particularly satisfying to have that breadth.
Indeed. Okay, well, thanks very much for organising this, Jane.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's so good to have people involved in the arts here and recognised for the work that they do. I'm just hoping that we can continue to put on live events and to support those people who are working so hard.
Okay, Jane Osler, thanks very much. Although I went along to the awards ceremony, I wasn't able to speak to Deborah at that stage, but I caught up with her at home later via Zoom, and I began by asking her how she feels about receiving the award.
Well, it's obviously very exciting getting this award, and I do feel predominantly that this is a reflection on the whole of Brentford, and certainly not just me. I do the programming, but the team that we have that's been working on this festival right from the beginning is quite extraordinary. We've been going, gosh, it'll be 20 years next year, which I can hardly believe it. It just only seems like yesterday. And quite a lot of the original team of volunteers that came in on the festival at the start are still helping out. And I'm amazed at that resilience. But we also recruit new people all the time. And we now actually have some paid staff as well. We're all part-time, we're all freelance, but it feels such a happy family. It's a really wonderful organisation to work for. So I'm absolutely thrilled that we've had this recognition.
And there was a second person who started it with you originally, wasn't there?
That's absolutely right. This is Claire Norburn, who left the festival a couple of years ago to focus on her writing and performing more. But to start with, we neither of us really knew what we were doing. We just thought it would be nice to put some concerts on. So over a cup of coffee, we thought, well, let's put on 6 concerts and draw in our professional colleagues to make up this first programme and see how we go from there. Neither of us knew anything about fundraising. Claire is now an expert fundraiser amongst many other talents. And a lot of this was learned on the job, to be honest.
But it has been very successful, and obviously the volunteers were involved, and indeed the audience members are fairly passionate about it.
They certainly are, and obviously we're always trying to interest new people in the festival, which is why we're constantly expanding the idea, and also just what do we mean by early music, because that doesn't mean very much to many people. I do remember once being called to do an interview at about 5 in the morning on a local radio station, and they actually thought that we stood for bright and early music. Really nice. They thought it was music that took place early in the morning. So I think we've got a long way to go showing people what early music is, really, is the first 1,000 years of music from all cultures, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, it's not popular music, but we do music right up to the 19th century. But it's performed on sort of instruments and vocal styles that are more appropriate to the music when it was first performed. That's really what we aim at. And one way I've found of making this clear to people is to say, imagine doing a concert of music by the Beatles or the Stones now. Would you use modern electronic instruments, or would you try to use the same guitars and the drum kits that they used and get that sort of very authentic sound? And that's really what it comes down to. We have instruments that are handmade, and that's another beautiful sideline to the whole business of early music, is reconstructing instruments based on copies of old instruments. So it's a lot of handicraft involved as well, highly skilled work.
You're saying it's not popular music, but some of it was very popular in its time, wasn't it?
Well, of course, I meant really it's not contemporary popular music. What we do like to point out to people is that this music encompasses all levels of music, right from basic traditional folk music right the way through to music written for toffs, the royalty in courts. And also there's sacred music, music written for the church.
And of course, some of that music, you talked about a range of different styles, and some of it was popular dance music, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, as well as the cantigas, which were for singing in procession, there's also quite a repertoire of dance music going all the way through. People like to boogie right from the very earliest times.
This is the sort of music that David Munro and the Early Music Consort made popular in their day.
They certainly did. They were one of the first groups to make this popular in the 70s. And I had the great privilege of actually studying with David Munro for a while when I was at university. So, win-win situation there.
Going back to the festival itself, it's actually managed to keep going in an altered form right through the COVID pandemic, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, we did. I mean, we realised during 2020, having planned our entire festival for the autumn, COVID was amongst us by spring, and it became very clear to those of us working on the programming that we just couldn't rely on it all being sorted out by the autumn. And my goodness, thank goodness we did. We went online and we did a series of specially crafted programmes. Crafted, made for the screen, not just filming performers doing a kind of pretend concert. But we had some, we had the recorder player Piers Adams sitting in a tree and playing music in imitation of birds on a local nature reserve. So we had another concert in a beautiful Elizabethan house of Tudor music. So we were able to get out and try to make a virtue of a necessity.
And partly as a result of the changes you've had to make because of COVID, the festival has now expanded from running just across 2 and 3 weeks in the autumn to running all year. And you've got various things coming up fairly soon, I gather.
We do. In fact, we have decided for next year, where our festival theme will be transition, that we're going to now not just do one big festival in the autumn, but to spill it out over three chunks, one in the summer, midsummer, one in the autumn, and one around Christmas time. We're making a start this Christmas. We've got a concert coming up on the 18th of December, which will be celebrating the music of Heinrich Schütz, amongst others. He has a centenary year next year, but we thought we'd get in early. We're going to do his beautiful Christmas story. And it certainly makes a change from the Christmas Oratorio and the Messiah. So we'll be doing that with all three of our Brempf choirs, plus Brempf players, plus the cornets and sackbuts of the English Cornet and Sackbut Ensemble. So it's going to be a marvellous concert. Of course, we are still limiting numbers. So if people want to come to that, they better look out for when booking opens.
And what's the date of that?
That's the 18th of December. I'm not quite sure when we're opening booking yet. We're still just opening booking right now for the online series, which will be coming out over the last two weekends of November, which is going to be featuring music that we filmed in concert during the summer and one concert from the autumn.
And of course, details of all this can be found on your website.
Yes, indeed. Our website is very, very active. You can book all your tickets through there. For the films at home that we're doing, we're actually trying a system I don't think anybody else does. We do V-tickets. These are voluntary tickets. You don't have to buy them, but you can. And I think that means those that can't afford anything, or if they just want to sample what we're doing, they can do so. But we do hope that most people, if they're going to sit and listen to the whole and watch the whole show, will actually do so. They're only £10 and it lasts for months. You can watch it over and over again and the whole family can sit round and watch it. So actually it's very, very cheap.
And if you want to get more regular information about the festival, there is a mailing list that you can subscribe to and get a regular newsletter.
That's right. We have a regular newsletter, which was one going coming out just now, which just gives you information about what we're doing, but it also lists other events, other early music events that are going on in the area. So it's, and we don't share anybody's email address with anybody else. It's a completely closed system and we only send one a month. So it's not a huge pile of spam coming your way at all.
Well, you certainly haven't let the grass grow under your feet in the last 20 years, Deborah.
Not yet,
and,
no.
Sounds as if you're still enthusiastic about keeping things going and trying new things in the future.
Well, definitely. The whole world is changing, and I think that the arts have got to change as well, or we'll get left behind.
I was talking to Deborah Roberts, this year's winner of the Brighton and Hove Arts Council's award for an outstanding contribution to the arts locally. And the main reason Deborah was given this award was the fact that she pioneered and is still running the Brighton Early Music Festival, or BREMF for short, which takes place every year in the autumn. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, which is www.bremf.org.uk. That's www.bremf.org.uk. You can also ring them on 01420 86267. That's 01420 86267. Now, you may remember that back in September we ran an item about the fact that it was no longer legal to burn wet wood in wood-burning stoves because of the emissions it produces, and that all wood you burn now has to be certified by the government. Well, the same thing also applies to various other solid fuels, and there's a certain amount of confusion around about what you are and what you are not allowed to burn. The Coal Merchants Federation have launched a campaign called Save Your Real Fire, which aims to tell people what they can and can't burn and how they can get hold of it. To find out more about it, I spoke to Julian Martin and asked him to tell me about the campaign.
The Coal Merchant Federation is launching a campaign called Save Your Real Fire, which really has two key objectives. Its first key objective is to inform consumers that, and reassure consumers that they can continue to use their open fires and stoves to heat their homes, because there's quite a lot of confusion around that. And the second objective is to inform the consumers about which are the right fuels to burn in their homes and on their appliances, and in particular about burning ready-to-burn smokeless fuels. One of the pieces of evidence that recently came out from some research we've undertaken is that if we look at Brighton, for example, 67% of people in Brighton don't actually know which fuels they can legally burn on their open fires and stoves. And so the Save Your Real Fire campaign through the Coal Merchant Federation is trying to address that and educate and inform consumers which fuels are right for them and right for their appliance.
Yes, because of course, back in May, the government introduced some new regulations about what fuels can and can't be burnt, didn't it? For example, basic coal is no longer allowed to be burnt, is it?
That's right. The government introduced new legislation which phased out the burning of some of the higher polluting fuels, such as wet wood, high sulfur fuels, and it started to phase out the sale of house coal. House coal will be completely banned from sale in May 2023, and the current new legislation basically means that coal can still be purchased, but only from approved coal merchants. But the aim of this campaign is to really educate consumers about the benefits of smokeless fuels and transitioning over to those low emission, affordable fuels, which consumers can do straight away without any changes to their appliances.
Now, the problem with coal is that it's, in addition to carbon dioxide, which pretty well everything emits when it burns, it also emits all sorts of other gases and particulates and things that can pollute the atmosphere.
Yes, that's right. And the Coal Merchants Federation has been working with DEFRA for some time now about how we do more to promote the use of smokeless solid fuels. And if your listeners want to go onto the website solidfuel.co.uk, they can learn all about which are the right fuels for them. And the ready-to-burn smokeless fuels emit 80% less particulate emissions than traditional house coal and wet wood. So they offer a very quick and simple solution to improving air quality in areas like Brighton and the rest of the UK.
This is all very well, but with the current situation, shouldn't we be encouraging people to get rid of their open fires and solid fuel stoves and so on altogether?
Well, as an industry, both the Coal Merchants Federation and indeed wider industry really does recognise the role it has to play in trying to decarbonise home heating and reduce particulate emissions in our towns and cities and the rest of the country. But switching to these smokeless fuels will see an immediate reduction of 80% in particulate emissions versus traditional fuels. And it's a very simple and affordable solution that is available now. Smokeless fuels are readily available from coal merchants up and down the country. If listeners just look at solidfuel.co.uk or indeed just go into their search engines online and find coal merchant near me, they will find a plethora of coal merchants who are able to help and advise them on what fuels they should burn. And coal merchants will deliver it straight to their home for quite often very small quantities. So people that are on tight budgets and lower incomes, you know, they can plan very effectively how much money they spend by using solid fuel. It's also important to remember, and I think government recognises this as well, is that there are over 200,000 homes in the UK that still use solid fuel as their primary heating source. And 40% of those homes are in fuel poverty. So whilst we transition from traditional fuels to smokeless fuels, clearly labelled as ready to burn, then it's important that we bring everybody along with us, and we don't want to leave anybody behind. So our campaign, Save Your Real Fire, is very much about trying to educate all of those consumers and trying to get them to engage with coal merchants, and likewise coal merchants with their consumers, to talk to them about what are the right fuels for them, what are the right fuels for their appliance, and what are the right fuels for their budget.
How can people identify approved coal merchants who sell the right type of fuel?
That's a good question. If you go on to the website solidfuel.co.uk or search for approved coal merchant near me, you will be presented with a whole host of approved coal merchants. And approved coal merchants are merchants that have gone through various forms of accreditation and been assessed by their peers to ensure that they present the consumer with the right and correct information. So that's a mark of reassurance for the consumer to know that they're buying from a trusted source. The other thing consumers need to look out for is the ready-to-burn logo. Now, this is a new logo that was introduced in May of this year following changes to government legislation. And all fuels should be marked as ready-to-burn. And if then ready-to-burn smokeless fuels can be burnt in almost every appliance and open fire up and down the UK. So I would strongly encourage people just to look for that ready-to-burn logo, because that is a mark of quality and assurance that they should look to buy from.
Okay, and how can people find out about what types of fuel they're allowed to burn?
Again, if they go to solidfuel.co.uk, that will inform people as to the types of fuels that they can burn on their appliances. Equally, coal merchants, their local coal merchant, will be able to advise them. Generally speaking, if you have an open fire or a multi-fuel stove, then you should really be looking to buy ready-to-burn smokeless fuels that's clearly labelled with the ready-to-burn logo. If you have a wood burner that can only burn wood, then equally consumers should be looking to buy ready-to-burn kiln-dried logs or ready-to-burn heat logs. And these are dried to less than 20% moisture and give out significantly less particulate emissions. These ready-to-burn fuels have all been approved by government, all been approved by the authorising body called HETAS, and they are a mark of quality and assurance for the consumer.
And there are some people around who don't have access to the internet. What's the best way for them to find out information?
Well, a lot of local merchants do advertise in local press. They do advertise in local shops, village shops, and so on and so forth. There is a telephone number for the Solid Fuel Association. They're open 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and they can advise consumers on all sorts of issues, not just about which are the right fuels to burn, but also about appliances and chimney sweeps and other issues they may have.
And presumably merchants who are members of the Coal Merchants Federation will make the fact clear on their advertising.
Absolutely, yeah. All merchants in England are now selling ready-to-burn smokeless fuels. And I would actively encourage your listeners to seek them out and to ask for ready-to-burn smokeless fuels, and that they'll be able to oblige.
OK, well, thanks very much for that, Julian. And hopefully it's been of use to the listeners to find out what they can actually burn and what they can't. I was talking to Julian Martin of the Coal Merchants Federation about the types of solid fuel that you can now burn and which types are no longer legal. You can find out more information from the Solid Fuel Association website, the address of which is solidfuel.co.uk. That's solidfuel, typed all as one word, .co.uk. Or you can phone them on 01773 835 400. That's 01773 835 400. Now, back at the beginning of this programme, we heard Fiona Longhurst of the RVS exhorting us to go and see our doctors about various ailments that we might have other than COVID. Although the pandemic has made doctors very busy, they're still not too busy to see patients about other ailments. One thing which isn't really an ailment, but a fact of life, is the menopause. It can have a huge variety of symptoms, and many women are understandably reluctant to go and talk to their doctor about it. Well, back in October, the world celebrated World Menopause Day. And just before that, Dr. Ella Russell, who's a menopause expert, contacted us at Grey Matters Productions and suggested that it might be an idea for her to come on the programme and talk about the menopause. Well, we accepted her invitation and we asked Maya Davis, who has experienced the menopause, to be our interviewer. Maya began by putting it to Dr. Russell that the menopause is a very important event in every woman's life.
Absolutely. Well, it's really important for us all, but it's particularly important for women of a certain age, I think. Yes.
Yes. And we all experience the menopause differently. We do hear about a lot of the common symptoms, you know, fatigue, insomnia, headaches, mood swings, anxiety, hot flushes, particularly disturbed blood flow, heavy periods, what have you. But we don't hear so much about weight gain. Why is that?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head in the fact that we know that there are at least 34 different symptoms associated with the perimenopause and the menopause. And this research by One-to-One has really highlighted that over 61% of women notice that they gain weight during the perimenopause and the menopause. And actually, this is more common in women under the age of sort of 50. And it really has a significant impact on women's quality of life and the way that they perceive themselves and their self-confidence and well-being.
What's your evidence for the effect on their self-confidence?
Well, I think women report that they're having a really difficult time anyway, sort of managing the symptoms regarding things like sort of hot sweats. They may be feeling very tired all the time. They may look in the mirror and notice that they've got sort of skin and hair changes and things like that. But we do know from the evidence that, unfortunately, as your estrogen levels drop in midlife, what will happen is that you will gain some weight, and that's all under the sort of guise of insulin and cortisol level changes as well. But also we know that it collects mostly around the middle. So women will notice that their usual pear-shaped body that they may have had up to the sort of their mid-40s suddenly starts to change, and they notice that they start to put on weight around their middle. And they may notice that they have weight on changes that may affect their upper arms, for example. And it really can impact quite significantly on how a woman perceives herself at a time when she may be struggling outwardly with people noticing flushing and things like that, and hot sweats.
You mentioned insulin as one of the factors. Is that one of the reasons why there is weight gain in women during the menopause?
Yes, there's lots of different changes. So estrogen has a really big impact on the way that our pancreas produces insulin and those metabolic changes that we experience. We know that fatty tissue, for example, can accumulate in areas where we may not have had it before. And that fatty tissue can hold on to estrogen because it feels like it's in a deficient state. So it tries to hold on to it a little bit more than it maybe did before. But as well as that, we also know that women will recognise and notice that their muscle strength may not be as good. They may lose some muscle mass, which also impacts on the way that we can control our weight and leads to weight gain. But our strength goes as well. And obviously, we all know that the menopause can affect your bones. It can lead to osteoporosis as well, unfortunately.
So what tips can you give women who are getting to the menopause stage, who are perimenopausal, or who might actually be in the middle of the menopause?
Well, there are quite a few different tips, really, that I would recommend. I still meet with ladies on a day-to-day basis who have not always recognised their symptoms, and it may have taken them 12 to 18 months to get to a point where they start to complete that jigsaw, if you like, and recognise that actually their sleeping problems, their joint pains, their weight gain, their period problems may all be related to sort of perimenopause and menopause. So there's certainly something about women themselves sort of doing a bit of research and a bit of investigation and knowing what their management options are. This research also highlights that a third of women do recognise that if they get help and support, it does help to improve their symptoms. But I think it's about reaching out for the right support for you. So that might be speaking to partners, husbands, it might be speaking to friends and family, it might be sort of discussing some of the impact that your menopause might be having in the workplace with your HR department, for example. But obviously there are organisations like the one-to-one diet where you can reach out to a consultant who may be able to help and support you specifically with the weight loss and the nutritional side of things. And obviously there's people like myself as well. So there's GPs, you know, other healthcare professionals who specialise in menopause management and supporting women, and reach out to us, you know, for help and support if you need it.
You mentioned your particular organisation. Can you explain a little bit more about what your organisation does and how well or how thoroughly your research was carried out?
Yes, so I personally am a menopause specialist, and what I do is I will see ladies on a day-to-day basis who feel that they need that extra little bit of input. So I'll meet with ladies and we take a thorough history and go through sort of their past history and sort of what their main symptoms are now. And then we'll talk about management options. So that always includes things like lifestyle, addressing lifestyle changes. So that might be looking at diet, for example, looking at exercise, looking at sort of alcohol intake, and talking about hormone replacement therapies if that's what women want to consider, or talking about alternatives if they don't. This research that was done by One to One covered over 1,000 ladies, and it really delved into some of the issues around self-confidence, well-being. And 1 in 10 women in this research actually said that their self-confidence was at an all-time low as a result of their perimenopause and menopausal transition. And that's really something that I feel quite strongly people like myself and others around us and the One to One diet could really help with.
And there was me thinking that my weight gain was to do with changing my job to somewhere where I got free biscuits, free cake and free lunch.
Well, it could well be to do with that. But I think we do need to recognise that, you know, hormones do play a big part in this weight gain. And to some extent, we don't have a lot of control over that. But there are lots of things we can do that can help to minimise the weight gain that is associated with the menopause too.
So where can we get more information about that?
OK, well, if you head over to the one-to-one website and have a little look at the research in a bit more detail and obviously look at the various different support systems that are on there or the site, they can signpost you to the correct advice and support. Organisations like myself, I'm the Yorkshire Menopause Doctor, and I've got a website and I've got an Instagram and Facebook account, so you can get some more information on there. But there is a lot of work going on at the moment amongst sort of the NHS and amongst menopause doctors like myself, in that we're trying to raise awareness and educate and empower women so that they feel a bit more able to make decisions that are the right ones for them.
Can you give me those website addresses?
I can, just bear with me. It's www.one, and then it's the number 2 1diet.com. That's the first one. And mine is www.yorkshiremenopausedoctor.co.uk.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Ella.
All right, thank you.
Maya Davis was talking to Dr. Ella Russell about the menopause. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to one of two websites. The first one is www.121diet.com, and the 121 diet bit is O-N-E figure 2 O-N-E diet. Or you can go to Dr. Russell's personal website, www.yorkshiremenopausedoctor.co.uk. And that brings us to the end of the programme. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine for older listeners, which may also be of interest to younger listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks. Until we meet again, it just remains for me, Richard Davis, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme and to wish you, our listeners, all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning has been a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.